Welcome to A Handful of Dust. This is a podcast all about Neil Gaiman's The Sandman comic, in which we talk about some of our ideas and themes that occur to us as we've been rereading the series. I'm Eamon.
And I'm Jenny. And as always, we're going to start with just a quick content note. As we mentioned in the past, some of the comics deal with dark and troubling subject matters, and we might refer to them or discuss them in depth in these episodes. So for more information about the topics in the books and that we mentioned in the podcast, you can see the notes for this episode.
And I've also got a little housekeeping note as well. This is episode 6. As we record, episode 1 has just been officially released in the feed last week. And somebody has already emailed us. Martin emailed me at mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, the email that's in the show notes. And he quite rightly called me out on the fact that we haven't really mentioned the artists of the book as we've gone along.
Yeah, we have been focusing a lot on story, and we should have been talking about the artists equally, I think. And I am also an art student and art history student, so even more for me to mention the art.
Well, I'm the comics guy. I should be mentioning them as well. So I'm going to mention Sam Keith and Mike Dringenberg, who were the creator artists with Neil Gaiman on the first run, and who I don't think we see again much, particularly not Sam Keith. We will pick out a couple of artists, I think, in this particular volume. I'm going to big up Sean McManus, who I think draws lovely art for The Sandman in A Game of You, and then again in one of our favourite issues in this book. But there's a couple of other artists we're going to mention along the way. Brian Talbot, famous for 2000 AD, but also for his own graphic novels. And we'll perhaps get to Jill Thompson later as well, I think, Jenny.
I think, yeah, we'll talk a little bit about Jill Thompson as well. And I think it's always worth remembering the excellent cover art done by Dave McKean, with that sort of like collaged, photocopied, paint splattery aesthetic given to the covers, which is sort of the thing that you always remember about Sandman.
Yes. I don't know if you've heard that anecdote that Dave McKean told about getting a colour photocopier and deciding to do all the things that the manual told him you weren't supposed to do in order to produce some of the effects for the glorious covers.
It seems very appropriate for someone who went to art school. That's basically what they teach you at art school as well.
And also perhaps Todd Klein, the letterer, who produces such distinctive lettering for the books, particularly when Dream himself is talking, but also when Delirium shows up and he does interesting things with the lettering, which is wonderful as well.
Yeah, we've talked quite a bit about how each of the Endless has their own distinct lettering and typeface that creates this sort of imagined world of the way they speak, which I've always really enjoyed.
Yes. So we will try and mention those as we go along. Here we are, Volume 6, Fables and Reflections, not Fables and Recollections, as I called it last time, as I recollected the title wrong. I also note that at some point I called the Dream Fiddler's Dream instead of Fiddler's Green, which I should have got, because Fiddler's Green is the sort of Nelson Navy sailor's nirvana, which is often referred to in the Aubrey Matrim books by Patrick O'Brien that I'm a big fan of. So I should have got that anyway. And he turns up in this volume, Fiddler's Green.
He does. And I think actually in this, does he not, maybe we'll get to it, but does he not make a point of being like, and remember it's green and not...
Yes, I know, he tells
green
me.
The colour. So yeah, he's on it. He's aware, I think, of the mistake that people make.
Now, I've been doing some more background reading, and what I've sort of come up with, or I think I've worked out, is that Neil Gaiman did have a pretty well worked out story that he intended to tell over 75 issues. What I suspect, I don't know if this is true or not, is that along the way he had some other little stories, or, you know, not so little stories he wanted to tell. And so occasionally he would work in these sort of single issue stories, because this volume is 9 separate stories, although there's big connections, but it's not a sort of like an arc of a story like, you know, A Game of You. This mm-hmm. is 9 individual stories, isn't it?
Yeah. I think we talked about this in the past, being like sometimes these individual issues being our favourites and standouts, and we're definitely going to talk about some favourites in this volume as well. So I do think, I feel like every time I reread The Sandman, I remember how much foreshadowing and world building is going on, but that each time I read it, I don't so much care about that. You know, like, I care more about these, like, one-off little glimpses into worlds. So I don't know whether that says something about me as a reader or something about the way that they're constructed and what appeals to me from them, but the big story arc is there, and it will get there. But okay. Yeah, I feel like, for me personally, maybe it's just it's like when you watch, like, fantasy sci-fi television and it's Monster of the Week, and then suddenly a big story arc comes in, you're like, no, just go back to the Monster of the Week, because the big story arcs, they work, but you can't do anything with them once they've been told. It's very hard, if you've done a big story arc, to then still have these one-off moments, these, like, jokey episodes or these, like, differently toned episodes, because, you know, you can't move forward from it. It's sort of like, what do you do once Buffy is fully PTSD'd out? You can't go back to being like, oh, fun singing episode, or, you know, like, well, no, that one does come up at that point, I guess, but it's hard to get that balance right, I think. And I think for me, Sandman kind of has that a little bit.
So you've mentioned your show, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I'll mention my show, The X-Files, and now all The X-Files are on Amazon Prime as well. So I've been watching those, but I'm not watching the conspiracy story arc stories. I'm just watching the individual Monster of the Week stories, which are much more fun, because all the conspiracy nonsense was like, oh, for goodness sake, not this week again, you know. Let's go back to the one about the stretchy guy or the vampires or the, you know. Anyway, so in this volume, two of the stories, one was published in a Vertigo preview issue. It's a fairly short story. The Song of Orpheus, which we'll get to, was a standalone special that came out at about the same time as A Game of You that we talked about last time. And interestingly, it's still in the comic box here, but it had a glow-in-the-dark cover, would you believe?
That's cool.
For the early 90s, you know?
That's perfect. That's what they,
yeah.
I want to see that original issue.
Okay, I will get it out for you. So, they are... And also, the stories in this collection are... They were arranged in non-chronological order, it seems, in the book. But I've grouped them together. Let's talk about the first group of stories, which are called Distant Mirrors. So that is Three Septembers and a January, Thermidor and August.
Yeah.
And they all appeared before A Game of You. What was the standout one for you from these three?
I mean, you can't set up a question like that knowing that everyone who's already listened to the Game of You episode of MCVC knows that Three Septembers and a January is one of my favourite stories of the entire Sandman run. So it's Three Septembers and a January.
So tell us a little bit. What's Three Septembers? Just remind people, which one is that?
Okay, so Three Septembers and a January is the story of the first and last emperor of the United States. So Neil Gaiman does his classic, take a little bit of history / folklore and wrap it up into the world that he's created. So this idea of this man in San Francisco declaring himself the first emperor of the United States and being sort of tolerated and loved in a certain way at this very strange time. Neil Gaiman has sort of adapted that story into the Endless's mythology. So creating a way in which this sort of like fantastical bit of history has this like fantastical origin from the Endless, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it does.
And I think it's done very well. He does that a lot, and I think in this case he does it really well.
And he's woven in some of the Endless. So we get dream and death, desire and despair crop up. And we get this idea again that the Endless sometimes, possibly because they are endless and they seek distraction from being immortal personifications of a concept, that they seek distraction by having some sort of games or interfering or setting each other challenges that involve humanity. And so it's almost like a wager between dream and desire. And dream gives this man, Joshua Norton, who became Emperor Norton the First and only, dream gives him a dream of hope that inspires him to become this fantastical character, the Emperor of the United States of America.
Yeah, I mean, we've had hints of it before, that despair and desire in particular, but also delirium, have this different kind of relationship than death and dream and destiny, who we've already met, in that they are the younger siblings and they like to have fun, which I think is appropriate for the things that they embody, this idea that there's like a push and pull between despair and desire, who keep, you know, who set each other little challenges or play off against each other, and delirium getting swept up in that as well. Those three ideas can all be, you can see how they're connected, and that they manage to pull in dream as well makes sense, that he is susceptible in a way to their pranks and their childish, you know, they're like younger sibling behavior, you know. It does. I've talked about it before, but I do love their interactions capturing that really good sibling energy of like teasing your older brother until he like comes and plays with you, or like, you know, like that sort of vibe is really well captured. I think any time like dream interacts with despair and delirium, but also desire as well, even though desire is often the sort of antagonist towards him.
And as you've said, it takes a little bit of actual history and the mythology of a place, and the place being this time San Francisco.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, I was listening to a San Francisco history podcast this morning because I specifically looked for their episode about Emperor Norton.
Mm-hmm.
And you're quite right. He was, I mean, it depends on your interpretation of his actions or whether or not he was mad. There is this line in the comic that says, his madness keeps him sane. And yet San Francisco sort of took him to their hearts and in a way protected him, looked after him, fed him, housed him, clothed him even in his, you know, his emperor's uniform. And when it wore out, they bought him a new one. And so he becomes this real sort of part of San Francisco. There were certain things he proposed during his lifetime, like he proposed a bridge across the bay. He proposed, would you believe, the League of Nations. I mean, slightly less, perhaps, sensibly. He also proposed that President Lincoln should marry Queen Victoria. But anyway, but yeah, fascinating piece of mythology and history. And Neil Gaiman, I think, has a great time with this story and includes some other real characters, particularly, you know, the young Samuel Clemens, obviously the writer Mark Twain, who appears in this comic. And it's fantastic. I just love this episode, like you. You know, it's one of our favourite issues from the run. Sean McManus on the artwork is just beautiful. And, of course, to cap off the issue, Death turns up at the end and is her usual cheery, perky, quirky goth self, isn't she?
Yeah, I mean, it's, we keep saying it, but like any time Death shows up, it's a good time. And I think this is one of those particularly great. It's just a page. She's just there for a page, and it's just the way her speech is written remains like, I think her more than anybody else in the comic is like fully established as a character and a personality in a way that I think it's quite hard to do in comic books. You know, it's one of those things about conveying tone and meaning through just words and pictures, and she always manages to come across as this incredibly warm figure. I was going to say incredibly warm person, but she's not really a person, but you know what I mean, like,
yeah.
And I think this one is especially where she's telling him that he's her favorite and asking to wear his hat, and it's just very sweet. Perfect.
It's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've met lots of kings and emperors, and I think I liked you the best. And yeah, can I wear your hat? Yes. So yeah, it's marvellous. Interestingly, because it's an issue that does feature dream, desire and despair. And
delirium.
And delirium. Yes, of course. Delirium turns up as well. And the death at the end. So nearly all of the endless that we've so far met. But I did notice in view of our sort of continuing theme of this reread, which is Dream being forced to do the right thing by other people, what he does for Joshua Norton is the right thing. He gives him hope. He gives him a dream. It's at least in the context.
Yeah, he saves him.
Yeah.
Within the story. Yeah.
But he's, in a way, he's again forced to do that by, this time, by the other members of the Endless, who are doing it as a sort of game, a sort of wager with him. So I just noticed that as we were rereading this, you know, he will do the right thing, but he has to be pushed or nudged.
Yeah, he does. But again, it sort of feels a lot like the Hobb-Gadlin storyline as well, that there is this genuine sense of, it's not friendship here. With Hobb-Gadlin, it's friendship, but here Dream has this sort of like almost protector vibe.
Yes.
I guess, because what we're seeing is him revisiting, watching over the Emperor as the other character, the other Endless come in and out and sort of pick and poke until to see if they can get some kind of reaction out of him. And I think that's a very interesting thing to set up, because we've talked a lot about what is Dream's sort of like motivation, if you'd say, towards humans, and we often see him being quite uninterested and aloof in certain circumstances, and then in other circumstances being very invested. And I can't, you know, it's another case where you can notice that it seems like he's more invested with male characters, with Hobb-Gadlin, even John Constantine, and here Emperor Norton, whereas with female characters he's often much more aloof and a lot more, I wouldn't, maybe just a form of like passive aggressive. He's like, he doesn't take as much interest, he doesn't invest as much in their lives, which is just, it will just keep coming up and up, I think, a lot. But I think we'll see other examples where he's equally passive aggressive towards the male characters. So it's not an exclusive club, but there's definitely a warmth that Dream is depicted as having towards figures like Hobb-Gadlin and Emperor Norton, who are particularly like, they're a particular form of like male character, which can be frustrating.
Right.
But I don't mind it so much in this story, because that warmth is there in everybody's approach to him, I guess, apart from Despair's, because Despair is by nature not inclined to have much warmth.
No. And it is, I don't like the fact that Emperor Norton moves through and four of the Endless in a way. He starts in Despair. Delirium says he should be mine, but he isn't. He's tempted by Desire later in the book. And then, of course, he's got his dream, which carries him through the book until he meets Death. So, yeah, interesting voyage for this character.
Definitely. And like you said, we get a snapshot of a sort of distinctly unusual period of history and an unusual place, which is San Francisco, this place of like lots of immigration, this place of strange creativity. And I think it's not often that a place is captured so well, and I think here we get a really strong sense of, you know, I've never been to San Francisco, and but I know a lot about it from pop culture, but I think from here we get a really good sense of like the history of the place and why it is perceived now how it was, because it's, you know, this is where it starts kind of thing. And that sort of like American folklore almost of these like people and places comes across really strongly.
And interestingly, Emperor Norton's protection of the Chinese immigrant population in San Francisco is true, historically accurate, even intervening to stop some anti-immigration riots against them. And then in turn, their protection of him was also historically accurate as a result, you know. And this amazing fact that, you know, was it something like 20,000 people attended his funeral?
Yeah, he's like, he lies in state. It's like a little footnote to the issue, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, so that's the first one. Let's, two more distant mirrors, Thermidor and August, the French Revolution and Ancient Rome. Mm-hmm. The Thermidor issue we'll probably mention when we get to the Song of Orpheus. Anything you wanted to mention about those particular two stories? Because we're probably not going to try and focus in depth on all nine here.
Yeah, there's a lot to cover. No, I think we'll mention Orpheus a little bit later on, I guess. Dwarf Thermidor we'll mention a little bit more. I guess it's just another example, both of them, of Neil Gaiman picking up a little scrap of history and weaving it into his story to greater or less extent. I feel like, I think the difference for me here is that these two sort of settings or contexts, the French Revolution and then ancient Rome, are kind of overused a little bit. And I would say that these depictions are not my favorite depictions of those places. You know, I think the cyclical nature of the French Revolution appeals to a lot of writers. You know, it's a good place to think about power and authority and violence. And I think that there's an interesting story woven there, but I don't necessarily think that it's the most interesting take on the French Revolution I've ever read. And with August, listeners who've heard me talk about other books and who have read it themselves will probably guess why I have a problem with August. The use of child sexual abuse as a plot point I find kind of distasteful in this circumstance, mainly because of the way, well, mainly because it's quite horrible to read about. And yeah, also because of the way it's sort of used as not a punchline exactly, but like the denouement of the story, you know, that's sort of like, and here's what we haven't been telling you the whole time, yeah, which I feel is quite an unpleasant way of structuring those stories, because it makes that act become sort of twisted in the way it's thought about. You know, it's another, technically what we've got here is another story about surviving abuse, and it's sort of, I don't know, it's sort of fuzzied by the fact of the way it plays out. I think it's sort of is harder to get to grips with.
Yeah, I mean, both of them depict, you know, the French Revolution and ancient Rome, they depict times and events that were, I suppose, noted by struggle and bloodshed, and they're difficult times, particularly, you know, the depiction we see of the French Revolution. It's a time of death and betrayal and bloodshed and going on. And then in August, with Emperor Augustus, there is the, you know, as you say, the content note that it is almost like his motivation, this idea of sexual abuse has been introduced to give him motivation to do what he does in this issue, which is slightly strange when it comes up. So there are, I mean, they're slightly more troubling. I suppose we'd note that Lady Joanna Constantine turns up in the French Revolution one, and that's the sort of payoff from the Hobgadlin story, mm-hmm, I think, from book two. So we finally get to see what Dream had commissioned her to do, which of course is the very important thing of recovering the head of Orpheus, which we'll come back to in a moment.
Yeah.
So that's the Distant Mirrors threesome of stories from this volume. The next one gets bracketed together under the title Convergence, and that's the issues The Hunt, Soft Places and Parliament of Rooks. We get a grandfather telling his granddaughter a story about a werewolf who is, strange enough, the sort of the hero, the protagonist of the story. Soft Places is about Marco Polo getting lost in a sandstorm and encountering some dream characters, including Fiddler's Green. There, I got it right. And then Parliament of Rooks is Leta Hall's son Daniel dreaming, appearing in the dream with the storytellers Cain, Abel and Eve, all of whom tell him a different story. Out of these three issues, which are the ones, or which one did you want to pick out for us to talk about?
I think Parliament of Rooks is both my favourite of the three and also the one that's most relevant to our ongoing story of, or ongoing look at the foreshadowing and world building within The Sandman, as it's like, it's one of the key ones that gives you, sort of connects up some of the dots that you've already been given. Like, we've already been introduced to Cain and Abel and Eve, but, and even Matthew the Raven, but here we're given a few more clues and directly told how they are connected. And the other two, I enjoy The Hunt. The Hunt is like good, solid storytelling. It's literally, it's like perfect framing of a device of a story being told.
Yes.
And the interjections of the like conversation between the grandfather and the daughter. And also that idea of the story being not mythology, but actually about the grandfather.
I read something this morning that compared it to the framing device for the film The Princess Bride, where Peter Falk, as the grandfather, yeah. is telling the guy from the Wonder Years the story, and it keeps getting interrupted. Mm-hmm. And it's very much, you know, who's telling this story? You know, and it's a very, it's quite like that, isn't it?
It the is. Grandfather. It has the same energy.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think the story is solid. I feel like it picks up a lot of Eastern European folklore.
Yes.
Like the Baba Yaga is the sort of one that stands out to me.
Yeah.
But it also mentions sort of references to Gypsy Romani culture as well. And I think I'm not hugely versed on that folklore as much. And so maybe that's why for me the story doesn't quite like tap into that place of like connecting with something I already know about, if that makes sense. And again, the Marco Polo story is the same. Like, I don't actually, other than knowing roughly who Marco Polo is, you know, I haven't really engaged with that sort of aspect of history so much. So it was kind of a little bit like free-floating for me. And it's another, or maybe it just feels that way. Well, no, I would say it's another issue that is a lot of reading.
Yes.
And a lot of sort of like paying attention to little hints and clues, which, as I mentioned when we talked about Seasons of Mist, when I'm reading comic books, can sort of make me sort of zone out a little bit, and I'm sort of just turning pages without really paying attention to artwork or writing or anything, because I'm just sort of like, well, I'm going to skip to the end kind of vibe.
Right.
So yeah, I think out of the three of those books, Parliament of Rooks remains my favourite.
So in a comic about stories and myths, we get a standalone issue where they tell more stories and myths, and we get in turn Cain, Eve, and then I think Abel telling Daniel these stories, all beautifully illustrated throughout the whole issue by Jill Thompson, who particularly changes her style, I think, for each of the little individual stories, particularly because you've mentioned this earlier on in the episode, that the Endless can behave in a childish fashion, it seems. We get the first appearance of what we should, I guess, we call the Little Endless.
Yeah, the Little Endless.
Yeah.
Which I'm going to persuade you to do a spin-off episode on as well.
Oh, are we? Right, okay.
I think that we should. Yeah.
So beautifully illustrated by Jill Thompson.
Yeah, and I think we've talked about how Brief Lives is one of my favourite runs of the book. And she illustrates that. And so I feel like Jill Thompson is the Sandman artist for me, even though there are so many and, you know, she only illustrates like a fraction of the entire run. But when I think of Sandman, I think of her art and her depictions of the characters. And this little world that she builds of the Little Endless as well has its own little mini spin-off as well that she sort of takes ownership of. So I feel like maybe just through my perception, like she is part of like how the Sandman is built in my brain, if that makes sense, as much as Neil Gaiman is like her influence in the way she drew certain characters really has an impact on me, or did have an impact on me, and so I remember her the most. Like, she's the name I remember when I'm thinking about Sandman artists.
And I think I'm right, this is possibly where she first shows up in the run.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say that she then spins off a little bit of Neil Gaiman mythology with the Little Endless into a separate run.
Yeah, which that she wrote herself, I believe.
Right, which I guess by the sounds of it, we're going to be talking about at some point.
I definitely have, I don't know how many of them were published, but I definitely have a Little Delirium book
right
somewhere. So I think we should talk about that one at the very least. You will like it, I promise.
I look forward to it. So, Parliament of Rooks, fantastic stories within stories, and ending brilliantly with Daniel back in the waking world after his nap and his mom picking him up from the cot, and he's got a black feather, a rook's feather in his hand, and she says, how did this get here? Which is marvellous, because we've had the story about the Parliament of the Rooks and what they're actually doing when you get this meeting of birds, which is great fun as well.
Yeah, and I think, again, this is a really nice little there's lots of good character building moments here. Like Cain and Abel are obviously very established characters, but Matthew always has something like witty to say, which I've always enjoyed, the Matthew the Raven, and even Eve herself. But I think Lita and Daniel's little glimpse into this single mother with her young child is really well captured in just a few pages. I love the phone call you hear her having when she puts yes. Daniel down for her nap, talking about like not being able to turn off her mum speak when she's around adults, like cutting up somebody else's steak for them or like pointing out a fire truck, I think, which yes. feels very like authentic and also like a good way of capturing Lita and Daniel, who will become more important as we go on. But like, I think these two or three pages are just like so perfect and so lovely. And again, it shows like what Neil Gaiman can do in just like a few speech bubbles, like we've talked about with Death. In just a few speech bubbles, we know exactly who Death is and exactly what kind of person she is. You know, she's friendly, she's warm. And here with like Lita, we get a like perfect sense of who she is. Like as a single mother, we've known quite a lot about her, but this is where she feels like she's really established as like a character.
Yes.
Which I love.
Yes, it's it is actually, you know, a wonderful page or two for Lita, just that we get to know about her and about her difficulties as a single mother. And yeah, I can imagine lots of parents with young children who've been going down lockdown recently will appreciate her comments about it at the moment. Yeah. Okay, so that's Parliament of Rooks. That's the convergence issues. The last three stories contain two biggies. Uh-huh. There was the special, or rather there was the issue from Vertigo Preview, which is a standalone called The Fear of Falling. Mm-hmm. This is the one about the theatre director who's on the point of giving it all up and then has a dream about, appropriately enough, climbing and falling, in which Morpheus does appear. It's very short. It's nice to see, for a change, a male character going through the ringer instead of a female character.
But it is, again, it's a male character who Dream shows, like, warmth and compassion towards.
Yes.
To, like, persuade him.
Helps him.
Yeah, to knock him out of his funk and, like, help him. Which, again, I just, you know.
He helps him being prompted or told to by anybody. He actually just does it this time for a change, doesn't he?
Yeah. But it's a very, like, it's a very good issue. And it's, like, it was a special issue. It was a sort of, like, almost maybe a way of like onboarding and introducing people.
It was, yeah. It was like, it was an introduction in the Vertigo Preview. So this is, I guess, around about issue 47 when Vertigo started with Karen Berger as the editor, and they put out a Vertigo Preview issue, which is in your comic box here. Includes, I think, Shade the Changing Man and Enigma and a few other strange comics that they were putting out.
I didn't know that Shade was in the same time period. That makes sense.
Yeah,
I've been reading the new Shade the Changing Girl at the moment, and I was feeling like it had very similar Sandman vibes, so that probably explains it has similar roots.
Yeah
it's a really, I love the artwork in this issue as well. It's a lot bolder than some of the other ones we see, so I should probably know who the artist is. Let's look it up. So it's Kent Williams, the artist, and yes. colored by Sherilyn Van Valkenburg. Yeah, it's like really bold comic art that I associate with, I guess, don't really know what I'm sort of, I guess with that, a similar kind of like, I don't know why it feels French to me.
Right. Okay.
It feels like, yeah, coming from a slightly different world than the rest of the books.
Okay. I mean,
sort of independent comic world, maybe.
I don't know Kent Williams from anywhere else that I'm aware of. It is very impressive and lovely looking stuff. And I have found the listing for the Vertigo Preview. It included a promo ad for the Death miniseries, The High Cost of Living. We've mentioned Enigma, Black Orchid, Doom Patrol, Hellblazer, Shade the Changing Man, Swamp Thing. So all those sort of Vertigo titles that would fall under that remit, included in a little sort of... There was even Sandman Mystery Theatre, where they sort of gone back and started telling stories about the Golden Age Sandman, you know, the pulp adventurer. So lots of little snippets in that one issue to get people introduced to the idea, I guess, of Vertigo as an imprint. So, talking about great artwork, let's get to issue 50 of Sandman, which was the issue called Ramadan, originally intended to apparently come out earlier in the run, but the artwork by P. Craig Russell took a long time, let's put it that way. Some people say this is the best issue in the whole run of Sandman I was reading this morning. This is the one about the... Is he a caliph of Baghdad?
Mm-hmm.
The emperor of Baghdad, basically, going into a deal with Dream in order to preserve his perfect city, or the idea or dream of his perfect city. It is absolutely beautiful to look at. Let's say that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's stunning. Especially, I feel like, when Dream shows up at the end.
Yeah.
There are some really beautiful panels with his cloak in particular. The way it sort of... It's an interesting combination of styles because it's very, like, Art Nouveau. It's very... Reminds me a little bit of maybe it's the colours, like Little Nemo in Slumberland, that kind of aesthetic. Is that... Would
yes.
you say that's the same?
Yeah, yeah, I think so, yes.
There's but obviously there's also, like, roots in...
Well, it's very fairy tale. It's very fairy tale. I mean, yes, it's sort of the Land of Oz, Little Nemo in Slumberland.
But also there's obviously an influence of like Islamic art and culture as well. The sort of the way the panels are framed with these designs is very reminiscent.
Some of the panels are just absolutely gorgeous to look at. I'm looking at the page you've mentioned, which is when Dream first appears in his cloak of stars. And it takes up a sort of like single panel down the whole left-hand side of the page. Mm-hmm. And it is just a stunning piece of artwork that probably should be hanging in a gallery somewhere. But the whole book, as you say, with this sort of Islamic art, inflected art, I guess it's Todd Klein doing the lettering as well, because also doing that sort of, what would you call it, calligraphy, the sort of...
Yeah.
You know, like an illuminated text lettering for it. It is absolutely a stunning and beautiful issue. Did you find it had as much impact on you in this book of nine stories as it perhaps did when you first read it? There's a leading question.
I remember the visuals very strongly. I remember the sort of, it's not the right comparison maybe, but like the journey he takes through his palace.
Yes.
Which I would say is the like bear hunt journey of like he goes through the woods and he can't go through them and he can't like that sort of like,
yeah.
And he comes to the next door and he unlocks it. That is very like the rhythm of those panels is I remember quite strongly. And then the visuals as well. The story, again, I don't like reading apparently. And it's just, it's so wordy. There's so much to take in and there's so much in the visuals going on that for me, it doesn't quite work. And I wouldn't, so I would say that the narrative is lost on me, but the visuals remain, if that sort of makes sense.
Yeah. I mean,
and again,
there is a wonderful journey through this book, and it's very, in the comic page, it's very left to right and down the page, isn't it? His journey through mm-hmm. the palace and deeper. And I don't know if it's Todd Klein or P. Craig Russell between them do these wonderful things with sort of scroll-like captions wending away across the page as well.
Yeah.
And then we get that beautiful page when Dream appears. But when I read the story again this time, I just thought, oh, okay, yeah, he makes a deal. Fair enough.
It does feel... It reminds me a little bit of Seasons of Mist, where we get this, like, long, elaborate journey, and then in the end it's like, oh, and it's over.
Yeah.
Quickly, it's done. I don't know whether it's just that particular narrative flow is not something that I really enjoy. So it just particularly doesn't do anything for me, really. And then the epilogue of this, the one-page epilogue,
yes.
where we see what would
modern
be,
Baghdad.
I guess, 90s Baghdad.
Yeah.
I can sort of see what they're going for, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
This sort of a reminder of, like, this sort of like fantastical world that might have been built up in stories and mythologies, which we still regularly consume, has roots in a real place that we as a Western culture have been entirely cruel to. I can see what they are trying to do. I will note that it's kind of feels a little bit like it points to the cultural appropriation a little bit more than it maybe did when it first, you know, like when it first came out, probably wasn't the first thing people thought about. But now it's much more common for us to say, well, actually, you kind of appropriated the story within, you know, it's a sort of like within trying to tell this story, you've actually appropriated the story, which is problematic as well. So I don't know if that final page is as effective as they wanted it to be.
Yeah. It does have the sort of older man telling a young boy a story concept again as well.
Yeah.
Which, you know, has happened a few times now, hasn't it? But yes, as you say, we could admire the Islamic-inspired art of P. Craig Russell, but it does feel perhaps a little bit odd looking back at it now. And I was thinking... if they'd still allowed the World Fantasy Award for short story to go to a comic, that this might have won it again for Neil Gaiman and his artists, for P. Craig Russell and Todd Klein. But when I read it in this book, I just thought, oh, that's quite nice. Let's move on there to the more important stuff.
Yeah, maybe because we've mentioned like this. What's the story that comes before it in the publication? Is it Parliament of Rooks?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
In this trade, yeah, it is. So Parliament of Rooks is real, like, back in the dream world, world-building, foreshadowing, major foreshadowing. We've already had the Orpheus story, which we're going to talk about next, for even more foreshadowing. And so, like, to have this story, which is beautiful but very disconnected from that foreshadowing, I think it's reading them in this order is particularly hard because it's, like, I want to get to the next book, especially if you're me and you know the next book, the next volume is Brief Lives. It's like, yeah, there's too much here for me to take in right now. I need the story. There's a big story. And I've already said I don't particularly like story arcs, but at this point, you can't avoid the story arc. The story arc is happening fully. And I'm pretty sure that for the rest of the run after this, we'll get mostly... everything will be in some way connected to that story arc, I believe.
Yes, I think so. The World's End stories could be seen as standalone, although I think there's definite links to what's happening in the main story arc.
So, yeah, it's to borrow from my world of curation, it's the curation of this story to put it at this point is the problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe if it came earlier in this trade, it would have a greater impact. So I don't know, maybe that's you know, we keep talking about where to introduce people to stories and like what stories to give them, but maybe it's if you've haven't read Fables and Reflections in a while, maybe go and start with Ramadan, maybe go and like flip to the end and see if it has an impact. Yeah, like read it as a standalone story rather than reading it as part of this volume might be the way to find a way to appreciate it. It's not doing it justice to have it at the end of this book, I think.
Okay. I will mention just very quickly, it does end up with the fabled perfect dream city of Baghdad in a bottle.
Yeah.
And for DC comics, a city in a bottle, you have to think of the of Superman's city of Kandor in his bottle. And I think we've seen that bottle.
We've seen it already, haven't we? Yeah.
In Sandman's trunk, in the dreams trunk, yeah, haven't we? All right, let's turn to then perhaps the heart of this volume 6, which is the Song of Orpheus, a special issue released to run alongside the run. We'll perhaps mention Thermidor again, but this one particularly. And the little note I had was that Neil Gaiman thought he'd be able to include the story of Orpheus by just referring it to it from time to time in the comic, but realised from people he was speaking to that perhaps not everybody was familiar with the story of Orpheus, and therefore he felt he needed to tell the whole story.
Oh, see, that's interesting, because I was like, everybody knows Orpheus. He spends a long time telling us who Orpheus is, and I was like, oh, I feel like everybody knows the story of Orpheus, do they not? So,
well, apparently not. No, and apparently that may be why, I don't know, but that may be why he did this as a special side issue rather than as part of the main run.
Yeah.
Because he thought he needed to bring people up to speed on who Orpheus was. And of course, as everybody knows, I think, listening to this, it's established that Orpheus, the Greek singer and poet and prophet, was in this story is the son of Dream and Calliope. And we see them both at the wedding of Orpheus and Eurydice. Is that how you pronounce it?
I was always, would always go with Eurydice's, but I don't
Eurydice.
Know why.
Okay.
Eurydice, yeah.
So Eurydice. We see them at the wedding.
I've heard both, definitely.
Right. And we see them at the wedding where Dream is back in his stuffy, gothy, not getting involved mode. He's having a bit of a dream moment, isn't he?
Yeah, and I guess we have to establish this is pre-capture Dream.
Yes.
So it's sort of established that he's always been a little bit of a dick, but he was especially a dick before a guy trapped him in a cage for 100 years. So yeah, he's very aloof in this. And like I mentioned, like before, we see him be cold and aloof with women quite a lot. And we see him be warm with men, quite like friendlier with men. In here, we see that he can be cold and aloof with his own son and his own wife. So it's not exactly a binary, but yeah.
He can be Dream the dick with everybody, and he's quite cold
even
and aloof
at a
in
wedding.
This. Even at a wedding, even when asked to dance at a wedding by his own partner, and he refuses.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, he has within him Dream, he could presumably dance fabulously with all the Dream energy. But no, he won't do it. So we get the retelling of the story of Orpheus and Eurydice, and we introduced to a bit more endless lore. We find out that Delirium was in her delirium phase already in the time of the Greek myths, or of ancient Greece. And we get, is this our first meeting with Destruction?
It is.
The brother?
It definitely is. I think this is the first time we've learned his name. And it even takes like a little way. We meet him before we know his Western name, I guess. Like, well, rather, we learn his Greek name before we learn his.
Yes, because we get their Greek names. Yes. We get their Greek names in this issue as well as their D names. And we get the wedding scene, and then we get that terrible moment when his wife is lured away from the wedding and Death has to sort of wander off as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know what's coming. We know that Eurydice is going to die and that Orpheus is going to try and make a deal with Hades to reclaim her. And, you know, the famous myth of Orpheus and what he does on his journey through the underworld. But along the way, as you say, we're going to get huge, I guess, foreshadowing plot points.
Yeah.
We get the establishment that, you know, Orpheus is Dream's son. We get the family of the Endless. We get another male character being put through the ringer, I suppose, in Orpheus.
And another female one.
Yes.
Yeah, this is definitely like, I mean, you know, this the Greek myth as well is Orpheus's journey quite literally through the underworld and through life. But Eurydice does not, even though she is killed off quite early, she does not have the greatest run. And again, another content note for this issue, because as throughout women's existence and throughout the Sandman run, women cannot avoid the threat of sexual abuse and rape at any point. That is a sort of, I think I learned Greek myth from childhood like stories, so that was probably not included in my versions that I had as a child, but I'm not sure if that is sort of an like existing point in the story of Orpheus and Eurydice, but definitely wasn't in the children's comic book that I had of
no,
the Greek myths.
Probably not.
Probably
that
not.
Eurydice was running from a sexual predator,
mm-hmm.
from an attack, and that she runs basically into the path of a snake and then literally into the arms of Death, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I stand corrected. You're quite right. It's another woman being faced with attack and abuse.
I mean, maybe Eurydice is the first woman to be fridged. I mean, she probably isn't, but she's definitely an early example of a female character being killed off to motivate a man's narrative.
Yes, and she's fridged for the tale of Orpheus.
And Neil Gaiman is unable to even prevent that fate for her here, which is disappointing.
And sadly, we get to know so little about her.
Yeah, she's literally just like beautiful and friendly.
Yeah, beautiful and friendly, and, you know, trying to get everybody to have a good time at her wedding. And yeah, and then she's fridged. She's Greek fridged.
Tale as old as time.
We also get some depictions of Dream's palace in the Dream Inn with the guardians at his doorway.
Yeah.
Who are great characters to crop up from time to time. What have we got? We got a sort of winged horse, a hippogriff, and a griffin, is it? And a three mythological beasts who guard the door. Orpheus has a great conversation with Destruction.
Yeah, and we get to meet Destruction as a sort of, like with the others, we get to see what Destruction's all about. And Destruction's seems like a fun guy.
Yes.
We'll learn more about him later, but like, yeah.
He seems like a nice guy, level-headed,
sensible.
Seems
like a good uncle.
Yeah, he does. He has a good uncly chat with him. And then I love the sort of little joke where Orpheus is then taken into the world of death, or to Death's Gallery. And it looks like he's caught her out of time in possibly the apartment she lives in the first Death miniseries, because it's got modern decor, a teddy bear and a bowl of goldfish.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely get the sense that death exists in all times.
Yes. And she does that wonderful thing when Orpheus is disquieted by the appearance of her room, so she transforms it into sort of more classical, something befitting Greeks and mythology, I guess.
Yeah, but even that look that she creates with this like floor-length gown is not a particularly like Greek look. I think it's interesting that we see, you know, you mentioned Orpheus's Dream's castle. Not Orpheus's, Dream's castle we see here, and it is like a Greek palace with columns and statues of gods. And he himself, Dream, is shown in like, well, we've seen him earlier in a sort of like robe. So there's always this way about like Dream conforms to the context he exists in and through the eyes of the people who see him. But death is always, has her own look and her own style. Which I think it's just a little bit of Neil Gaiman's like character building that he puts in there.
So Dream is, his son basically comes to him and asks him to help. So we get, and he's quite, again, he's, because it's a male character, Dream's quite warm to him and encourages him to grieve and accept bereavement rather than go in on this quest. Is this a chance for Dream to have done something differently, or is he actually at this moment being the most fatherly we've ever seen him?
I don't know. It's definitely one of those sort of enigmas, I think, of the book, is the way he treats Orpheus. And we'll see sort of like three meetings with Orpheus throughout the life. So this beginning, this one where he seems standoffish, but ultimately might be attempting to guide him to not make the decision that we know he definitely will make. It's interesting. And then, of course, when he comes back, the problem is that it's like that that classic, like, you've disobeyed me, so now I won't, like, care for you in any way. So ultimately, at the end, I think Dream behaves like a sloth. He starts off, he tries to behave like a father and do the fatherly thing and, like, look after Orpheus at this point. But when Orpheus defies him, he gets sulky and teenagery about it again and is like, all right, fine. You didn't want to listen to me, so I don't have to, you know, I'll do like the limited amount of looking after for you now, sort of thing.
Well,
it's just Dream being Dream.
It's Dream being Dream. So, you know, I'm sure people will remember that Orpheus, having failed in his attempt to bring his wife back from Hades by doubting and just turning back when he was told not to at the last moment, then becomes this sort of wandering sort of singer and poet, dishevelled, until he is attacked by, I call them the Greek Furies. They're not the Furies, the kindly ones of the Sandman. They are the Maenad, I believe is the name for them. In Roman myth, they would be the Bacchanti, the followers of Dionysus, who believe in revelry and party and drink and singing.
Yeah, because I think we should note that the Greek Furies are in this as well. That's another bit of foreshadowing. But yes, these are the Bacchanti.
So he is torn apart, but he is immortal, so his head remains. And of course, if we go back to Thermidor, the head of Orpheus had become somehow, had ended up as a sort of relic in the hands of the leaders of the French Revolution. And Dream has sent Lady Joanna Constantine to rescue the head and bring it back. And of course, in Thermidor, the father, Morpheus, has no contact directly with his son himself. He acts through other people. Because at the end of the Song of Orpheus special, we get this moment where Morpheus picks up the head of his son lying on a beach, props him up on a rock, rather strangely, and tells him, "We'll not meet again."
Yeah.
And turns his back on him and walks away from Orpheus. So having tried to be momentarily a good father earlier in the episode and given him a good advice, at the end of the book, he's back to being bloody useless Morpheus again, isn't he?
Yeah, there's definitely a sense that he sort of washes his hands of this kind of thing and moves on, which he is uniquely able to do. Yeah, I think there's always this question of how much Dream knows of, like, the future or things happening. But we think we mentioned in A Game of View this idea of, like, boons and pacts and laws and the things that Dream manages to, like, tie himself up in, and how aware he is of the fact that he has created the problem that he then doesn't want to solve at the end. And this whole thing with Orpheus that's been foreshadowed from, like, the first volume, we're now seeing how the tangle has been created. You know, we have this, like, this problem, and we see how the tangle has been created. And at a certain point, there is, you know, Orpheus acts under his own power, but he's told not to do something, and I think, as everybody knows, the one thing you don't tell a child, your child, to do is don't do that, because your child will immediately want to do that. So I think you can say that maybe Dream knew how things were going to end up. I mean, beyond this book and, like, the final acts of The Sandman. But I think also he's just a bad parent as well. Like, a very in some ways it's understandable. He does understandably bad, but also we know him to be this aloof person. And so, like, to be both aloof and seemingly uncaring, and then to also make this dumb mistake of telling your child no, and your child immediately turning around and being like, "Well, fuck you, I'm going to go do it anyway." To be like, "Well, it was not great parenting right there. Not amazing." So I don't know. I feel like I struggle to give Dream a break, but this one, there's a little bit of ambiguity there, I think. Just a little bit.
I just think it's interesting, very interesting, in a way that he is the creator of his own doom, because he is, you know, he cannot resist having partnerships. His relationship with Calliope has produced a son. He says on the beach, his Orpheus begs him to help him die, and Dream refuses, and then says, "We shall not meet again." And of course, we're going to find out in the next episode that he was wrong. We will find out, because this is huge setting up for what's to come. Okay, yes. it's probably the big issue in this volume, isn't it? The Song of Orpheus.
It definitely is.
But in terms of favourite issues, I think we know what we're going to say. I like A Parliament of Rooks. I like the Little Endless, Jill Thompson's artwork. But we love Three Septembers and a January, just for the marvellous tale of the Emperor of the United States. We haven't even mentioned the Cobweb Palace and the King of Pain and all that. But it's just, that's a lovely issue, isn't it?
It is. I think those two issues together are pretty emblematic of what the Sandman does write, if that makes sense. Like, what the comic book, what people, well, I don't know, we've talked about, like, the different things that people like about the book, but I think for me this is really emblematic of what the book does really well. And it's like Three Septembers and a January being this, like, little moment of history being wrapped up into this fantastical world, and this sort of making history seem interesting and fantastical is, like, perfect, with little touches of character really nicely brought out. And then Parliament of Rooks is similar, but it takes mythology and like religious stories and like a little bit of nature and sort of weaves them all together again with like little touches of character and a cute baby as well.
Cute baby Daniel. You can't go wrong.
I think those two really are like the way that Sandman works as a comic book. They really show the best of what it has to offer. In a very like compact one issue, you know, although there's lots of foreshadowing in Parliament of Rooks, you could just read it and be like, cool, it's just a baby. That's just a baby. We don't know anything, you know, we have no pre-existing knowledge about what this baby is or where this baby goes. Like, it's just a baby. So yeah, I think those two remain the best.
Those two, I mean, Orpheus is the most important probably in Thermidor, but the Three Septembers in a January and the Parliament of Rooks are just fabby stories in the middle of this run.
I mean, I think it's interesting that that Neil Gaiman didn't think that he needed to include the Orpheus story. And I actually feel maybe, I don't know, I think you can go both ways, but like, I think there are definite hints. And like, if you know the story of Orpheus, then you should be able to piece them together. So I understand why he needed to put it in. If you didn't have context for the mythology of Orpheus, you would be a lot, you'd be very lost. And if you hadn't picked up on like the mentions of his son or the mentions of the Furies or the mention of this like blood boon, you'd be very confused by the end of the run. But it does also feel like there's little bits in there that are really significant, but actually as a whole, for me, the story is a bit basic because it is just a telling of Orpheus, the mythology of Orpheus, which again, if you know it, you kind of know it already. So like the best bits come from the destruction and death and dream featuring, and then the little hints about like the specifics of the story, like Orpheus making the Greek Furies cry and them being vengeful about that, and therefore them being sort of wrapped up in this ultimate tangle that will like lead to the end of this, of the Sandman.
Okay, an interesting volume in a way. More unfortunate examples of women being fridged in order to motivate men. Sadly, more tales of abuse. But along the way, there's some great storytelling, there's some great art. Your favourite, probably Jill Thompson. My favourite, probably Sean McManus. And some huge foreshadowing of what's to come in the next volume or two.
Yes.
Anything else you got in your notes?
Not really. I'm just thinking a little bit like just 2020 pop culture context. I've been thinking about the film Portrait of a Lady on Fire that came out earlier this year, and that looks at the Orpheus, well, doesn't look at it, but references the Orpheus myth a little bit within it, and sort of looks at the twist of gender within it, and like what that final meeting between Orpheus and Eurydice means, like, which I think is often sort of forgotten about a little bit. And here in this book centers Orpheus's experience of like doubt and then turning around and losing everything. Whereas Portrait of a Lady on Fire sort of takes a little bit different look at it and looks at Eurydice's as well. And like those sort of things. So I think it's not particularly relevant, but I think it's important to note that like Orpheus is a story that still persists in other ways. And yeah, has had other readings of it taken as well.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen that film, but by sound of it, perhaps I should. Okay, cool. Well, that will wrap us up for Volume 6, Fables and Reflections.
Next time we will be looking at my favourite book, looking at Brief Lives.
Come back and join us in a week's time for episode 7, Brief Lives, one of the high points of the series that we've both been looking forward to, yeah?
Yep, it's going to be good. I'm going to talk about Delirium a lot. But also, there are things in it that are problematic, so sorry.
Here we go.
We can't get through. I don't think, have we got through an episode yet that hasn't had a problematic topic?
Nope.
No. As we said, I think Sandman's always been a sort of like grown-up comic book, and so obviously often goes to like some darker places, and so every run pretty much has one or two moments that feel tonally very different or stand out as maybe being a little bit too dark or too gritty, I think.
And we are looking at it from 30 years on as well.
Yeah.
And attitudes, our expectations, and understanding. Yes.
Yeah.
Things are changed.
Well, things are the same, but our eyes are open.
There we are. That's us. We're not asleep.
Yes.
So until next time, I'm Eamon.
And I'm Jenny.
And thank you for listening to A Handful of Dust.
Bye.